Before we begin, I want to give a huge shout out to all of our patrons over on our BBF, BFF tier, and that includes Nini, Catlin, Delia, Elizabeth, Christian, Evelyn, and Cassandra G. Thank y'all so much for your support. If y'all want to support the continued production of Bitter Brown Femmes, feel free to support us at patreon.com/bitterbrownfemmes. The link is also in the description. Your donation, anywhere from $1 to more, gets you little rewards such as live streams, early episodes, and your name in the credits. All right, well, hope that you like this episode.
We'll do it live. We'll do it live. Fuck it. Do it live. I'll write it and we'll do it live. Fucking thing sucks.
Bitter Brown Femmes is a podcast hosted by Ruben and Cassandra that tackles social, political, emotional, and community issues. It was born of a necessity to take the Latinx, Chicanx community dialogue beyond mere identity empowerment and feel-good comedic fluff that, although have their place, it tends to oversaturate social media. And into a realm that is critical of identity and society while advocating for marginalized identities. We also aim to disrupt liberal complacency and systems of oppression by living up to our motto, dismantling shit while talking shit. Please help me welcome Ruben and Cassandra into the space.
Woo. Thank you.
Thank you for welcoming us into your space.
Yes.
Your virtual space.
I feel you though.
So, hi to everyone that's here. My name is Cassandra, she, hers.
Hi, my name is Ruben. I use he and they pronouns.
And we are Bitter Brown Femmes, which, you know, I don't know. I'm like, every time we do a talk, we're like, we know like five of our fans are in here, five of our listeners. But everyone else is like, who?
But Abigail, did you want to open up the panel?
Yes. So the way we will be going about their presentation will be, we will be starting off with a panel with some questions, and I would like y'all to start thinking of some questions for them as well, beyond the ones I have created. But after that, we will move forward with our discussion. Okay. Thank you for the love in the chat. Yay.
So much love from Santa Barbara.
Yes.
Is that where we are, Santa Barbara?
Yeah, can you now feel the breeze? And the privilege?
Stop. I feel it.
I feel Oprah, my girl Oprah. I feel her energy.
Is she from Santa Barbara?
No, but she lives there. Like, she has a house like in the hills somewhere.
Oh, okay.
Miss Markle, I don't know. Oh, Meghan Markle, shut up. Sorry, we're like getting sidetracked by the chat.
I don't know California like that.
Abigail?
So the first question, as it relates to our theme of our conference, we have lived through approximately like more than 2 years now in a pandemic where we have seen like multiple decisions made from our government, and it has really exacerbated a lot of the inequalities that we already experienced pre-pandemic. So considering this, what do you foresee for the future of this country in terms of navigating this public health crisis?
God. I'm like, that's a lot. I feel like a politician right now.
Yeah, same.
They'd be like, they wouldn't have the same expression as me.
It's going to be a difficult step forward for Democrats to prove that they're somehow still the good guys, right? Because we're going on our second year under Biden and under a House and Congress that is all Democratic, and somehow like nothing has gotten done. I was talking to Cassandra late last week, and you know, as like a single mother, like technically, like Trump was, you know, they sent you more checks than under Biden, right? Like, under Biden, we're seeing like the lift of like the rent, the suspension of rent, right? We're seeing return to kick homeless folks out of their home, especially if you're, well, y'all are from the West Coast, you're from Santa Barbara, like you're hopping to skip away from LA. Like we just saw what happened to Silver Lake and Echo Park, right? Because of the freaking Super Bowl, they cleared hundreds of homeless folks out of their home, and we're currently witnessing, I mean, just this week, trans kids are being disallowed their very own existence, right, in Texas and in Florida, right? Like, and this is all happening under a Democratic, like, government. So it's going to be hard for them to continue to wave this flag of, like, lesser evil when a lot of us are experiencing the things we feared under Trump are happening now, and there's less noise about him, right? Like, we are also a stone throws away from Roe v. Wade being like repealed, right? And that should terrify folks. Like the fact that, like, you know, Biden and his whole Democratic cabinet is like just sitting on their hands at the moment, should tell folks about where their priorities are. Meanwhile, we have billions of dollars, trillions even, to, you know, start aggressing other countries, to fund wars, to fund apartheid in Palestine, right? Like, there will always be money for the U.S. to establish its global military power, but there will never be enough money to feed people. There will never be enough money to house people. And I think that we thought all this evil was happening under Trump, but now a lot of us are experiencing it in a different manner. Do you want to expand, Cassandra?
Of course. One of the things that I had during election season was, I know, and a lot of people were talking about, you know, once, if Biden does get elected, that people are going to go back to brunch. People are going to go back to, like, it's cool, you know, the evil is defeated, Trump is out of office. And that's exactly what happened. That's exactly what happened. So for me, like, when I was talking about elections, and I did not vote for Biden. Absolutely not. I just could not bring myself to it, but I do acknowledge, like, I did at that time recognize people wanting to vote. You know what I mean? When you're in that position, like, it is what it is, right? But what I had said during election season was, like, okay, if Biden wins, because then what? Like, that was the question. Like, what are you going to do when Biden wins? Because not only do we have, like, Trump in office for 4 years, that so much happened under him, and you think that someone else taking office is just like going to erase all that, and like Nazis are going to go back to hiding. And no, like what it did and what a lot of us knew what was going to happen was that it was going to be a lot scarier because Trump lost. So that means that, like, racists and like Republicans like Abbott, I feel that, you know, I'm from Texas, so like seeing what Abbott has done in the last like 2 years has, like, I mean, which he was always, you know, Republicans are always this way, but I feel that after Trump, Abbott has just done so much to be like, kind of like in this, I don't know what the word is, just like, they're upset that Trump lost. So now they're going to do everything in their power to take, to, you know, shove it in Democrats' faces, or like, you know, because all of a sudden Abbott started trying to build a wall in Texas. He's just done so much shit, and that's just in Texas, right? But across the US, things have not changed, or they've gotten worse. And that was the question that I had, like, what are you going to do if Biden wins? And for a lot of people, that has been nothing. That has been.
You don't think people have held him accountable?
No. Yeah. Like, people are like, we're going to hold him accountable. We're going to go to the White House.
And, we're going to go to the White House and like protest. We're going to push him left. Stop Biden.
We're going to stop it. We're going to push him left. And it's like, it's just a lot of nonsense. And just a lot of the things that Biden has done, like if Trump were to have done any of this, but it's what we knew was going to happen. For example, like this week, right? Like we're seeing, which I don't really want to talk about right now, but we're seeing what's going on with Russia and Ukraine, right? And I was just thinking about, like, when Bush was in office, there was a lot of anti-war movements. There was a lot of building and organizing around anti-war. Maybe a lot of us don't remember that, depending on how old we are, where, you know, a lot of us weren't, maybe you were in high school and that politics wasn't like a thing, but there was anti-war movements. And then Obama took office and the same thing happened. They kind of just filtered out because they're like, oh, you know, like Bush isn't in office anymore. We don't need to. When Obama was like doing the exact same thing, if not worse, but people are like, oh, okay, like first Black president, Obama's so cool. And then Trump took, and it's like, that's the same thing that happens. Like Republicans are in office and it's outrageous and we're upset and we try to organize around it. And then we push that evil out, the worst evil. And now it's everything is cool because it's being done by someone that we deem not as evil or someone that's on our side when they are the exact same. So I do agree with Ruben that I think, well, as far as like in my circles, I know there's a lot of liberals who are still, you know, and their delusional fantasies about what the Democratic Party is. And I don't even think it's really delusional. I think that in the end, a lot of the people that still side with the Democratic Party are privileged in one way or another. So it's not that much of a outrage for them to be outraged about immigration or about imperialism because it doesn't really affect them, right? Like they're only upset when it affects them directly. So, but I've seen a lot of people, I think, within like Trump and even now that are just disillusioned about electoral politics, or maybe you still want to participate in electoral politics, but you know that it's shit and you know that the work doesn't end there, doesn't begin there. It needs to like expand. And if you're like seeing how we went from Trump to Biden and you really like sit there and analyze what has changed during even just talking about like the pandemic, like, did it really make a difference that Biden won? Do you feel safer? Do you feel taken care of? Do you feel like you trust your government? Like it's the same shit, if not worse.
Yeah, so, I think.
Go ahead, Ruben.
I just think about how like there was more deportations under Obama than like the three presidents before him combined, right? And I think about how in Biden's first year as president, there was more people in detainment in the border than Trump had, right? Like the numbers blew up exponentially. And specifically, there's not only that issue, but also the ways in which this administration does not see that as something that should be taken seriously. Like just look at the Speaker of the House, right? Biden's Speaker of the House consistently has to be called out because of how demeaning they are to the issues that matter to people. Like, I don't know if y'all were aware, but the only reason that we were able to order at-home test and PPE, right? Like they gave us like what, 2 tests per household and 4 masks per household.
Hey.
That was only because during a press conference with the Speaker of the House, a reporter asked Biden's speaker, like essentially like, hey, is there any way y'all can give folks like, protective gear and like at-home tests? And the speaker mockingly said, yeah, why don't we just give everyone candy and free shit, like all that, like not like that, but like essentially like, why don't we just give people handouts? And she said it in a mocking tone and it made such headlines, right? Because she was essentially talking down to people who really who needed like protective gear, who needed at-home testing, that is what pushed that administration to finally send us tests. And I don't know if y'all signed up for them, but I signed up as soon as they were ready, like as soon as they were made available, and I just got them like 2 weeks ago, right? So I literally had to wait like almost 2 months to get tests, to get PPE. Like imagine how many folks put themselves in harm's way at that time, how many folks passed away in that time. Like, I mean, that's something I think about often. Like my father passed away, you know, just a month of COVID, just a month before the vaccine was made public. Right. So I always think about like how things don't happen fast enough in this country because they see us as expendable. Right. My father being part of the prison system was seen as expendable. Right. There was protests to have Governor Newsom release prisoners who were, you know, at risk and things like that, like my father. And since the beginning of the pandemic, and nothing happened. Right. And instead, we had disproportionate numbers of COVID death in prisons and in marginalized communities in general. But because we don't see people in prisons as human, things like that happen, right? And that's all tied to like who we see as a lesser evil making these decisions. So how do I see this country moving forward? Unless we can speak candidly to our communities about the need for us to be activated and the need for us to be involved. Honestly, I feel at this moment, the the calling to be more involved in local government, right? And that might be a scary thought for folks, but we have to be more present in the decision making. We have to be more present in, honestly, our government officials should fear it's their people. Otherwise, they're going to do things that are not in our favor, right? And the Republicans understand this fully, right? The bigots fully understand this. And that's why they're regularly, like, you know, fighting for their rights to own guns and shit. And that's why the government tends to lean conservative consistently, is because they are afraid of their conservative voters, whereas they're not afraid of the liberal voters, because not only are a lot of us young and hence don't show up to vote, but a lot of us also are working class and generally disempowered, right? So I think moving forward, in order to impact things in a positive way, we need to talk to our communities about, like, what shit that's going down and open their eyes to it. I think a lot of folks did peace out already. A lot of folks said, well, my voting was done, you know, see you in 2 years when it's time to vote again, right? But things are happening now, right? Trans kids need our help now. Like, there's so much urgency now, and I think people need to be aware of that. And so that's something that that's an immediate task we can take on.
For me, I think it's about building communities, and kind of in the face of everything that happens, whether it's like an attack on trans children, an attack on migrants, on reproductive rights, etc. Like, when we have strong communities and strong organizing movements, we can combat that. And it might not be on this, like, in this legal way where we're involved in any kind of electoral politics, but it's like, I know, for example, like in Texas, reproductive rights are under the attack. How do we show up for people that need reproductive care, abortions, et cetera? And it's like, we build these communities that's like, you need money, you need this, you need to drive out of Texas. Like, how do we set up these networks? Oh, like trans right now, right? Trans children and their parents are under attack. And one of the ways is like Abbott wants to make it like, if you're a teacher, you have to disclose if there's a trans child in your classroom. Also, I think in Florida, right? And also, if you're a parent and you have a trans child, it's like child abuse if you engage in getting them like care. And it's also like, I haven't really read in detail like the bill, because it's I know it's just bullshit and it's not, because there's so many ways to show up for your child, right? It's not just like, it's a lot of misinformation. But what I'm saying is, like, if we were all collectively caring about each other, why would we feel the need to report a parent for something? Why would we feel the need to out a child? If we were all very clear about like building community, like we are in community with each other, and the government is trying to oppress this one marginalized group or attack this group. So how do we all build a fence around this person or these people, right? Right now, the way that, you know, which we talk about a lot, like capitalism, and that we've seen during this pandemic is like individualism, where it's like, I don't owe you anything, not even a fucking, like, I don't even have to wear a mask. That's how little people think about other people. So once we start seeing that one way that we do combat oppressive laws and systems is by like a very basic, like community care and building communities and showing up for one another. And also like, there's a lot that goes into that, but that's like the basis of it. Care is like anti-violence. That's how we combat violence and violence of the state. And that's one of the things that capitalism tries to teach us, is like not to show up for one another. And it ultimately like wins in the end, right? Because if I don't care about you, I don't have a trans child. Why should I care about that? I don't need an abortion. Like, what I'm, you know, it's just like, how do we start root, you know, just how do we show up for one another and build like communities with one another, where if something happens and it's terrifying and it's not going to be that easy, where we're just like, oh, we're going to protect you. Like, it's fucking hard. It's hard in the face of everything that's going on, but that is what, that's what I feel like we need to be focusing on, especially in these times.
Yeah, and I know there's like a lot of jokes about like being an empath, like as an empath, blah, 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 but like surviving this and like building communities does like require being empathetic, right? Like how do these issues like that have nothing to do with me like actually affect other people, right?
But being an empath is not the same as being empathetic.
I know. That's why
not during Pisces season. We're not doing this right now.
Well, be empathetic all other times except for Pisces season. but it does require you to believe like that people you don't know deserve a better life, right? Like that's one of the main, I think, issues that's happened with that have been like highlighted in this pandemic is the individualism that Cassandra has brought up. It doesn't only show up like, you know, I'm going to get mines. Like, you know, this doesn't affect me, so it doesn't matter. But actually seeing things the other way, it's like, even if I think things don't affect me, they will eventually, right? Like this anti-choice movement to control women's bodies, right? Specifically their reproductive rights. It is ultimately about controlling people. Right. So if you, first of all, like the first bar, like you should give a fuck about women and people who have uteruses, like A1. But if that is so difficult for you to relate to, if that's so difficult for you to care about, then all right, we'll set the bar lower. If the government is trying to control certain people's bodies, right? Like, what does that mean for you? Like, what do you think they're just gonna stop at like controlling people with uteruses? Like, that it's ridiculous to think that once we give them that inch, that's just where they're gonna stop, right? So this community building, this community consciousness requires you to understand that like the things that oppress others ultimately also affect you, and unfortunately that can also be, I think, when you're in a spot of privilege, a part of this realization is you facing the fact that like, because other people are oppressed, you can live better, right? And you might think like, maybe like as a brown person or like as a, you know, working class person, you don't have privileges, but you will find that once you tally the amount of things that are available to you, especially as university students, you will realize like, that we are in a different, especially as academics, we're in a different position, right, than a lot of the people we grew up with.
Both of you have raised several great points of what's going on and like the realities of what it means to like carry these privileges, yet also being like in.
Yeah, and before I forget, like
identities, yeah.
Before I forget, like there's like the National Network of Abortion Funds that if folks want to get connected with, like, that would be a good jumping off point, right? On Instagram, they just go by abortion funds, but they're technically called the National Network of Abortion Funds. And so if you want to find like a local network with that like is helping folks get abortions near you, they usually have like a catalog, or what do you call it? Like a phone book, essentially, of people you can get in touch with to help, because like they're the national one, but there's always somebody doing the work. It's something that we always try to talk about, is that like when you, things might feel like really hopeless, but understand that like if you care about an issue, somebody else does as well, right? And you might think like your issue is super specific, but believe that there's somebody doing that, right? Like abolition is like super important to us, right? And specifically the way that LGBT folks are affected by the prison system is really important to me. And there's literally an org, a national organization, Black and Pink, that is devoted to those issues, right? And they have chapters in every major city, right? Like, so there's always somebody that cares about the issues that you do as well. And it's just about finding them. Luckily, for better or worse, we are, we live in the age of Google. It can be easy to connect through there, right? And it might be a process of like trial and error. Like, you might not vibe with folks all the time, but as you start entering certain spaces, right, that cater to issues you care about, you'll find your stride.
Yeah. And just need to shout out West Fund, which is in El Paso. So I have to shout out, but also because you know, we're West at the
Fund.
Yeah. We're at the border, and so that also brings a lot of other challenges for people trying to seek reproductive justice here. At the border, there's a lot of people that cross from Juarez to get care here. There's people here that are undocumented that cannot go to Albuquerque, like some people do in New Mexico, which is 4 hours away because of checkpoints, where there's a lot of national abortion funds that don't care about border towns like El Paso and RGV in Texas. So just, you know, got to center the most vulnerable there. But how do we look at the questions here?
They're in the chat.
I've been reading them in the chat. So far we have 3 questions. Pretty good questions. I can read them to y'all.
Sure.
And then go from there. So the first question that came up was from our coordinator, M. How has your podcast helped you in your community advocacy work and organizing? And then from one of our interns, Keon.
I'm sorry, can we just go one at a time? Because I can't. Can you repeat that?
Yes, I'll read it again.
I have it. How has your podcast helped you in your community advocacy work and organizing?
Yes.
I feel like it's made me accountable to things. Like if I'm not doing something, I feel very self-conscious about, like, I'm not doing something right now. Like what, how can I get involved? Like, how can I, like, can I write something? Can I be like, I always feel like if I'm not writing about an issue, like I better be working towards the issue, like addressing the issue, right? Like since my dad passed away, I've taken a step away from the internet for the most part, but that's allowed me to re-engage with groundwork again, right? Whereas before, I felt really called to consistently write to bring attention to things. And that's because there were so many eyes on me that I felt like I needed to put my proverbial money where my mouth was, right?
Yeah, for sure. I think for me, it's just like, I don't know, this is like an answer to the question. having a podcast, having any kind of platform, it's kind of like, it's a responsibility in a sense. And for me, like, I always try to like center El Paso, obviously because I'm from here, but also because, like I said, being in Texas, being at the border, there's always like, we're overlooked or we're only like talked about when it's time to like be used as propaganda. There's just so much going on here that I feel like as someone with a podcast, as someone with a platform, I need to like bring attention to these issues. And maybe, you know, it might not get the attention that it needs, but I did my part in being able to uplift voices here at the border here in El Paso in one way or another. I didn't realize how many, I think, people listen to the podcast from here. Like I was telling Ruben, like some of my friends, obviously they know who I am. They know like I have a podcast, but like people that I don't know, or maybe I follow online, but I don't really know them. I've noticed like listen to like the podcast. So like, that's really cool. Mostly because I've had people tell me that I'm like the worst thing to come out of El Paso for talking shit about like Robert O'Rourke, for example.
Don't come for my Betito.
So having people like in here, you know, like kind of acknowledge the podcast or like what I do or what I say is like kind of cool. But yeah, it is a responsibility because, you know, we're like making these episodes and we talk all this shit and we call people out, and it's like we also have to hold ourselves accountable to that, especially because we have like a public audience, right? They're like, who am I to be like, oh yeah, like go out there and do this and like go do that, and then I'm not doing shit, you know, like I'm just recording episodes but not actually doing anything that I say.
That's also like why we were very hesitant to like be like, you should go out and vote, because it's like that was not where our hearts were ultimately, and like we couldn't really push people to engage in a process that was ultimately not gonna look after them. Like just like the demographics alone of people who listen to us, it's mostly like Latinx women and Black women. Like, that is our audience, right? And so to be like, yeah, go vote for Biden, right? The person responsible for like the 94 crime bill, like the person like responsible for like, you know, the liberal state that Obama created from 2008 to 2016, like that wouldn't necessarily, like people forget that like the Black Lives Matter movement like started taking off during Obama's time, right? Like, so that wasn't necessarily something that we felt comfortable doing. And when we finally spoke out, like, you know, this is how we're voting. We didn't even say like, you should go out and vote. We just said like, this is what we're doing as far as our voting. You can take it or leave it. Like, a lot of people got pissed at us because we were like, you know, pissed at us on both sides, like, because we, you know, came out in support of Bernie Sanders, right? There was people who thought that was like a liberal move, and there was people who thought that we were hurting Biden's chances of getting elected. So ultimately, we try to give people the knowledge so that they can act on their own, right? Because we also, I think we're hesitant to be seen as the people that have all the answers, right? I forgot how we got here, but here we are.
Question. I see the questions now. I can read the next one. Thank you for that question, by the way. Next question. How do we reconcile people who are within our community / spaces who may do things or act in ways that compromise our safety? So we get this one a lot. And I think that is because a lot of us have to deal with that. And it's hard. I think a lot of us go into community spaces, organizing spaces, and this is from personal experience too, and you think everyone here has one goal and everyone here has the same political views and everyone here cares about other people because we're fighting for this or we're fighting for that. And the reality is that's not true. Community spaces, organizing spaces are not unaffected by misogyny, by assaults, homophobia, transphobia, etc. Like, it still exists in these spaces. So I think a lot of us need to reconcile with that first and foremost, that just because we're all here fighting xenophobic policies doesn't mean that we're all, you know, free of being violent or being hurtful towards other people, right? And then we have because we're in these spaces and we think that way, then it's even harder, I think, to talk about these things. And it shouldn't be, right? It should be like, how do we deal with conflict? And how do we differentiate conflict and abuse, right? Because a lot of people, they like to like say that conflict is abuse and vice versa. And how do we talk about it? How do we hold people accountable? How do we hold people accountable while keeping other members safe? How do we continue the work? Because a lot of the times when these things happen, a lot of organizers and community members don't know how to deal with abuse, don't know how to deal with conflict. And what happens is people linger out, people get in a fight, people get their feelings hurt, people take the perpetrator's side, et cetera, et cetera. And what happens at the end, on top of all of these people that are involved, is that the work just fizzles out. And I've been there. I've been in organizing spaces where things like this happen, and then the work just, everyone goes their own ways because there wasn't a way to have community dialogue. There wasn't a way to approach these things, and people would rather just not be a part of the space for whatever reason. And then the people that end up hurt are the people that you're supposed to be. And like, for example, for me, when something like this happened similarly to me, we were doing anti-gentrification work, and something like that happened where there was a lot of talk about assaults, a lot of talk like transphobia, misogyny, and we had meeting after meeting, but nothing was being resolved. People were fighting, like nothing happened. Like, what happened was like everybody went their own way, and the people that we were supposed to be helping that were dealing with gentrification kind of just, they were just left on their own. Because why? Because people in this organizing space couldn't come to an agreement about how do we handle abusers? How do we move forward? How do we keep people safe? And so just to expand on that, it's like, we get this question a lot. And as someone who I know Ruben has been a part of like a dynamic like this, it happens all the time. And I think that first we need to, like, I don't know, this goes a lot, I think, into organizing. Like, there needs to be, I want to say, like, a lot of us have acuerdos, and I don't know how you say that.
A plan.
Like a guideline, not a guideline, like, for example, like, this is the space, these are the basic rules of, like, if you're in the space, like, what's not tolerated, what are we here for, if this happens, how do we, like, you need to have a plan. You can't just, like, everybody come down here and let's organize against this thing, and if something were to arise, then we'll, you know, no, like, it is going to arise. Like, that's what I'm saying. Like, we need to, like, come into these spaces knowing that these things exist, and how do we prepare ahead of time so that that doesn't happen, right? And a lot of, like I said, a lot of us just go into it like, everyone's here, everyone's like, no, it doesn't work that way. We need to start with ourselves in our own circles, even if it's not a community space, even if it's like a friendship between you and your friends, because that, again, those things exist in everywhere. Like, we can't really, like, just assume that misogyny and abuse and violence doesn't exist, and even in, like, personal relationships, right? And how do we, sorry, I'm, like, going around circles, but, like, I think we just need to start with, like, ourselves and our relationships and our community spaces, and, again, kind of go from there and have a plan and read about it. I know that there's a lot of, like, books, and some of them are not good. There's a lot of podcasts. There's like, things that community organizers, community spaces, whether that's in school or outside of school, can do to, like, know how to approach these things, because it is going to happen. And, like, I can't sit here and tell you, this is what you do when this happens, because I don't know either. I'm in community spaces where we still have meetings and things still happen, and it's, like, still sometimes uncomfortable as much as we are around each other to talk about conflicts that we have with one another. And it shouldn't be, but it is, because a lot of us are not used to it, whether that's, like, the way that we grew up with our parents. Like, we were not allowed to talk to our parents about how we felt. And then we're in school, we're taught that, like, as children, like, we should just deal with things. So, like, as a society, we're taught to not deal with conflicts. Like, we'd rather, like, deal with it in a violent way, or just, like, excuse ourselves of it. So it really just comes down to, like, trying to learn about it and teach ourselves and have a plan for, and it's probably not going to be the most perfect plan, right? Like, we're all still learning, but it needs to be in place if we're going to be doing, first and foremost, the work. But it, like I said, it's not just about, like, doing organizing work. It's also in our friendships and our relationships and how we interact with one another.
Yeah. So first and foremost, like, as Cassandra was pointing to, there needs to be a plan ahead of time. And here are a couple books that can help you set up a plan on how to deal with abuse, right? There's, I think, my like Bible for these types of conflicts is The Revolution Starts at Home by Leah Lakshmi, Piepsa Samarasinta. But in it, there's no less than 40 ways to deal with abusers, right? And it goes from, like, rehabilitation to complete ostracization to enacting violence in revenge of abusers, right? Like, it covers all the avenues. And so when it comes to this, right, ultimately the choice of, like, how to enact either restorative justice or just whatever feels like justice is ultimately should be in the hands of the survivor, right? Because it's their autonomy that was robbed when the abuse happened. So it's their autonomy that should be restored. So first and foremost, when we talk about restorative justice, we should be thinking about, like, restoring the autonomy of survivors, not restoring the good name of abusers. Does that make sense to you? Because oftentimes I feel like there's this emphasis on, like, rehabilitating abusers, and that has its place and that can be important, but that is not how we begin healing. We begin healing by restoring the person who has been abused, right? Making them feel safe, making them feel cared for, and then move to the next step, right? Because often what happens is, because there's such an emphasis, I think, because we you know, we don't want to be the carceral state, what we end up doing is coddling abusers in social justice spaces, when instead we should be holding space for survivors, right? So what that would entail was to have is to have a plan before abuse begins, right? And not assume that it's not going to happen, and don't leave it up to be reactive. It's in our best interest to be proactive when it comes to abuse, right? So have a plan. Make sure that all the leadership in your spaces understands what is going to happen when abuse happens. Not if abuse happens, but when it happens, right? Because like Cassandra was saying, like we are not, just because we're socially conscious or whatever does not mean that we're suddenly like rid of patriarchal upbringings, of racist upbringings, you know, transphobic and homophobic upbringings. Those things are still very much in us. I would be very scared of anybody who claims they are no longer racist, they are no longer, you know, transphobic, you know, misogynist, because unfortunately that is, it's an active thing to have to continuously fight, right? We were raised in a society that is built to oppress, and it teaches us how to do that. What it doesn't teach us is how to uplift people. And so that is something that we have to continue learning. And a part of that is having a plan for when abuse happens, right? And so right now, as a reactive thing, I think the thing that should be prioritized is to see where the survivor is in their healing process and see what will help them along their way to recovery, right? And I think until the survivor has had a chance to express how they will find healing, the abuser needs to be isolated until y'all figure out what would best work for your survivor, right? And in after this moment and after this healing happens, a plan needs to be instated for how these type of scenarios will be dealt with in the future. Are you, you know, what resources are available to you, right? Like, is there shelter, you know, what shelter numbers do you have? What funds do you have? Abuse costs victims hella money. Just thinking about like, not only like therapy, which is expensive, but also like, how do I say this? When you are a survivor of things and you're living with a lot of PTSD, it can be difficult to do things like fucking cook your own dinner, right? It can be difficult to just fold your clothes and pick up around the house. And so having someone to cook for you, or ordering out, or having somebody help you to clean, that is all invisible, like those are all invisible expenses that we don't think about when we think about like a healing process for survivor. So having funds ready for folks that will help them in this scenario, having folks who are willing to do that labor for other people, for survivors, that is important to set up right now.
Thank you both. Especially in a time where like this topic like tends to like constantly like resurface, it's very important to center like the victim and how do we go about it, like you're saying, with these agreements beforehand.
And it shouldn't, yeah. And like when it, as far as it goes with like resurfacing, like we shouldn't let it, you know, go away. Like it should always be at the forefront of things, right? So, you know, first meetings, you know, have, you know, make outline the plan and then call that plan something, say like, you know, plan to deal with abusers. And then every meeting begin with like, we begin with agreements. So make sure to bring up that agreement as you bring up everything else, as you bring up like, don't hog the mic and everything else. Like, why do we spend so much time talking about like, you know, one mic, one voice or whatever, when like there's all these issues that should be at the forefront of people's mind. And that being one of them, right? Because it has everything to do with power dynamics, right?
Yes, definitely. We do have several more questions. And I think the next one lined up was from one of our participants. He'd said, are there any obstacles you face as Latin X creatives that discuss radical politics in the podcast industry? How do you manage having such a big social media presence and also taking care of your mental health?
I don't really understand the first question. I'm sorry. Like,
what are the obstacles you face as a Latinx creator that discusses radical stuff? Mm-hmm. Right?
Okay.
And I think, I mean, immediately is like, we don't get opportunities as much as other people do, right? Like you will not see us girl bossing like some other folks, right? Like you, it's just not, we're not very brand friendly when your topic of choice, like that, or your podcast theme is like how to be a Latina heifa. Like there's all these brands that would want to work with you and that fund the continuation of your podcast. So it's easier to create, right? It's easier to put out, you know, weekly 30-minute, 2-hour episodes when there's like a grand waiting for you at the end of every episode, right? But that's not necessarily the case with us. So that's one of the obstacles, is that like we have to, it often costs us more time and labor to put this out than we get back in.
I don't have anything to add to that. That's pretty much it. I think as a podcast, and I don't really think of myself as like a Latinx creator. I guess like I'm like, oh, I have a podcast, but outside of that, I don't really think of myself that way. But even just like outside of the podcast, just like I think when I first had started, when I was going by Chicanisma, for example, there were people at the beginning, and it's sad because I think that's when my politics were like the worst. that were let's uplift her and let's like share her content or whatever. And then as I started, like, you know, like if you followed me even throughout the podcast, like me and Ruben were doing our last, we recorded like a week ago, we were talking about how we've grown even within the last 4.5 years of the podcast. Like my politics are always growing. I'm always growing as a person. And I feel that once I started going left or whatever they want to call it, or more radical, people were like, no, yeah. Like, I don't want to do that anymore. Especially when we're talking about Latinx creators and what's like a big, when we think about Latinx content, you know, which we always talk about, I don't think Mito is like a big thing anymore, or I don't know, because I don't follow them, but like which we talk about in the podcast, the romanticization of identity, like, oh, let's like listen to Selena, let's like do concha earrings, let's like, let's do jefa moves and like all this stuff. But then when we're like talking about, okay, let's talk about how we're all anti-Black, let's talk about machismo, let's talk about how we're also like, not all Latinx are white, let's talk about these like uncomfortable conversations, and all of a sudden they're like, nah, I don't want to do that. And I think that some Latinx creators talk about it or address it, but it's still in this very like watered down way where they're like, I'm gonna address it, but just like enough to where people are still gonna fuck with me, you know, the brands are still going to kind of agree, but I'm not gonna go all the way. And you know, at the beginning when I had Chicanisma, aside from my shitty politics at the time, like I did feel like I always had to be online. I felt like I was all about questioning like what I post and how I word it, and like if people comment, I have to respond, and it was very reactive. And like now, like if you follow me on AnFem, I've gotten to the point where I will post, and this goes on to the next question about my mental health, like I will post when I have the capacity to post. And if you don't want to follow, because I know some people are like, oh, they don't post that much, I'm gonna follow, that is fine. Like before, I felt like I had to put content, and like I had like, oh, something was happening, I have to like, people are gonna look at me to like say something about, like in particular, like about it, just in this week, everything that's happened, right, in Texas, like people want me to say something, people need you to say something about the war, people want you to put out content and share things and constantly be available for everybody. And I've gotten to the point where like I'm not gonna do that. I did that. I've done that. And not only has it like cost me a lot of like mental like putting that first before myself, but it's also like, what do I get out of that? And that sounds very like, maybe that I didn't word that right, because I feel like going back to, I do have a platform, I do have like a responsibility, or I have the ability to share things and people are going to at least see it or listen. But it's like at the same time, a lot of the time, a lot of people just want to argue with you and they want to wait for you to say something so they can disagree and just like suck you dry of your energy, instead of actually seeing you as a person, a regular person. Like I'm a single mom, I go to school. Like I'm not going to be like on AnFem posting every single thing that happens, especially when people don't see me as a person. They just see me as like someone online who's going to share information with us. And yeah, if they don't, then they're this and they're canceled. And
Yeah, I think for me, it's just I just have learned to put myself first. If I have the capacity to post and I have the capacity to reply to people, then I will do that. But if I don't, if I don't have time, I don't have capacity, I don't have energy, then I'm not going to do that.
Yeah, I've kind of also taken that route. In the beginning, I felt a responsibility to post every day, literally, like, and respond to every comment. And like now I'm at a place where like, I think some realizations hit me. Like people feel more entitled to your time and energy, and they will call you out for what they perceive as a mistake, or they will want to argue with you because they believe you're a public resource, not a person, right? But they will never, you know, argue with the people that actually have power over their lives, right? They will never like go to their local government and like start shit, you know, like call them out for shit that affects them, right? But they will argue with a stranger online, right? Who they've never met, right? So understanding that like I don't owe people that energies has really helped me. And then going back briefly to the, you know, obstacles that we face as like Latinx creators, discussing radical things. Another big obstacle is that like the Latinx community, unfortunately, like they want empowerment more than they want justice often. I feel like we're in a time right now where Latinxes want a piece of the, you know, the pie, the power pie, essentially, and don't want to undo the pie, right? They don't want to fuck up this. They don't want to fuck up the system. They want to be part of the system. And so that has been a struggle to come, you know, face the fact that like the community sometimes does not want to be saved, and that it's actually a bother for us to be bringing up all these issues because they would rather be, you know, working towards becoming middle class or whatever, right? You know, even though I am like also an academic, I often like cringe when people, you know, post shit that's like, oh, my, you know, I don't have to work in the field like my parents, right? Like shit like that. I'm just like,
I hate the first gen. Like, I mean, as like a first gen person, like y'all need to shut up. Like, why y'all talking shit about your parents online for views? Like, it's so disrespectful. And people are like, yes, like get it, girl boss, immigrant, first gen, whatever. And it's like, I cannot. I'm sorry.
And so like realizing shit like that, where like a better approach to that would be like, you know, this is what I do for my career now, and this is how I'm giving back, right? But that's never part of the conversation. It always begins and ends where like, this is what I'm doing now to like boss up, right? This is what I'm doing now to get me, like get myself ahead, you know, shout out to my parents who are still working in the fields, like not like, this is where I am in life and this is how I'm giving back, right? There's always that missing step that like, I'm proud of your success. I'm never gonna be like, you know, trying to put other people, especially from marginalized communities, down for succeeding. But I'm also like, okay, and then what? Because us succeeding in capitalism doesn't fucking liberate anyone. Like everybody here's like a university student or something like that, right? So yes, you know, get your money, girl, and all that. But then what are you gonna do after that? Like, how is your success gonna help other people? And if you don't have an answer for that, right now is a good time to start thinking about it, because otherwise you're going to be far along that capitalist road and you're going to have nothing but, you know, money, right? Which is fine if that's what you want, but ultimately that is not liberatory. And as Nancy pointed, right, you know, what did Toni Morrison tell us? Toni Morrison, one of the big things that she told us is like, when you get through that door, right, when you know get into the room, your job then is to leave the door open for somebody else, right? Is to hold it open so that somebody can come into this space, right? And that also circles back to this individualism that we were talking about in the beginning, right? Like, we have to stop seeing success as like a individual thing and instead start seeing it as something that we can use to give back to folks, right? How did the pandemic impact your work, organizing, advocacy? How did it affect your ability to continue your podcast? How were you able to overcome this after the complete lockdown in 2020? That one?
Yeah, that's the last question that I saw
Yeah.
Oh, God. I don't want to be a killjoy. Somebody asked, like, how do you start to talk about abortion in a conservative Mexican household? We both have this experience because both of our parents, like, both of our mothers were, like, are, like, super conservative. Like, my mom was Catholic, yours is Christian, right? Mm. Like, they would be, like, picket sign holding type of, like, anti-abortion folks.
My mom's not going to do all that. She's just
Your mom didn't? My mom did.
but she's just going to, you know, she don't have time for that, you know? She's honestly, working.
Wow, not you talking down to people.
Not me being a first-gen girl boss. Oh.
honestly, it's about, like, how do I say this? This thing about, like, don't talk back to your elders has to go out the window when it's time to talk about, like, injustices, right? Like, so many of y'all are like, oh, you know, my abuelita's racist, but that's fine because she's old. It's like, no, that's not fine. Like, you know? She's old, but she's going to live here another 20 years. So, like, she's still going to oppress hella people. So, like, it's time for your ass to, like, get up and talk back to racist-ass grandma. And, like, if that's going to start some shit in your family, then guess what? A part of doing the work is starting shit in your fucking family, because if you cannot like confront your family, like, how do you expect to, like, change a bigger community? And, like, I think when you're young, that might be a little more difficult. So obviously, first and foremost, prioritize your safety. I think that I just came from a space where, like, at some point I decided that I cared more about confronting my family about their isms, about their bigotry, and about their conservatism. So I cared more about fighting them about that than I did about my own safety, right? Like, and that's, like, a risk I was willing to take. And that was just me deciding to put, you know, essentially my money where my mouth was, right? Like, I wouldn't pressure everyone else to make that decision. That's a very personal thing to do. But if you're in a place and you have community, once again, going back to community, that has your back, then you will be able to do things like confront your family, right? You will have people who can back you up when shit gets real in your home, right?
Yeah. It's a hit. Not every situation is the same. In regards to abortion, for example, my parents, they're anti-abortion because they're Christian, right? That's, like, not part of God's plan or whatever. And I think it's very interesting because when I'm a mom. And so I think that they assume that after I had my child, that I would be pro-life, or that meant that I was pro-life all of a sudden, which is a big misconception I think a lot of people have about abortion. People that are pro-abortion are actually mothers or parents themselves, because we know how fucking hard it is to be a parent, and not just be a parent, but go through pregnancy and deal, like, I've shared my story about birth trauma and my child almost dying. Like, it's traumatic. I'm now being a single mom. Like, there's so much. So, like, we understand what it's like to be a mother, a parent. So my stepdad at one point had asked me, you know, like, oh, now that you're a mom, like, are you still, like, pro-abortion? And I was like, yes, like, even more so. And I, before, like, not just with abortion, with other things, like talking with my family, I wouldn't even bring it up because I knew, because I'm scared of my mom, you know, you know, like that, you know, that dynamic where, like, you're not supposed to talk back to your parents, especially, like, in a Mexican household, especially about, like, these topics that are very, like, controversial or taboo. And I think the more that you start speaking out, or the more that, and it's not like this thing where I'm like, oh, mom, like, fuck you. You know what I mean? It's like, you have to, like, gradually, like, you're not going to have this whole hour conversation about abortion the first time. It's going to be like, oh no, I don't agree with that. And you don't have to, like, go into this whole thing unless you want to, but it's like, when you're with your family all the time, it's like, you kind of, like, implant, you start talking about it little by little. And
it's like over like a progression to me, like over a period of time. It's not like I'm like, the first time you brought up abortion, I'm going to go off on you and like, we're never going to talk about it again. It's like my parents now understand where I come from when we're talking about gay people, such as myself, when we're talking about trans rights, when we're talking about prison, and they don't agree with it. But I can tell, like, for example, my stepdad, he might not agree with it 100%, but he knows where I come from. And there's some things that he's like, you know what I mean? Like you're like, they're like, I never thought about it that way. And like I said, they might not agree with you. It might take like 10 times. Sometimes it might lead to a fight. Other times it's just like conversations that you would have with your friends. Right. And that's how we start. Like you can't really just expect, oh, I'm going to go off on my mom about abortion, and all of a sudden she's agrees with you. Right. Like, that's not how that works. It's like an active thing that you have with your family and your friends to like talk and have these conversations as a normal thing versus like a reactive thing.
And it might start as like, oh, I don't agree with you. And you know, the first time, and then the second time we'd be like, okay, say that they go through with the child, who's going to help raise them? Like, how do you expect to fund that if you're also anti-welfare? Like, if you're also anti, you know, housing for everybody. So like, start bringing up like issues every single time, right? And eventually, if in best case scenarios they completely change their mind, and worse, and if anything, you just become a thorn that gives on their side, that gives them the other point of view, so that they know that they can't just be saying like oppressive shit all the time, right? But yeah, like, start bringing up bullet points to like, if they bring up some anti-abortion, some anti-choice shit, you know, bring up different talking points. I don't agree with that. You know, pregnancy is difficult. Pregnancy is expensive. Having a child is expensive. Not everybody's ready for that. Not everyone can have it, you know, and so on and so forth. So little by little, I think we have how many minutes left?
Yes.
We're at time. So they're asking us if we have any last thoughts. I think for me, it's just like, I think despairing could often seem like the easy answer, especially in these times. But I think that also despair can often be a privilege, right? Because it often means like you are deciding not to take action, right? And so I think something that I want to leave folks with is to take stock of the things that you do have and find hope in the things that you want for your community, right? And bridging that gap between what you have and what you envision for your community will outline the actions that you need to take in order to get there.
Yeah. Right now, this last week for me, I've been overwhelmed. And sometimes that happens with things that are happening in the news. Like I said, with Texas, with Florida, with what's going on with Russia and Ukraine, like everything this week for me, like sometimes you do feel hopeless. A lot of the times you feel like, what's the point of sharing, like doing anything, right? But I think, again, once we come back to community and you have other people that sometimes you're like, hey, this week I checked out, but I'll see you next week, because I know that those people are going to be there. Those people are still continuing the work. Those people understand where I'm coming from. And if I'm feeling low, they're going to show up for me. And then when they're feeling low, I'm going to show up. And then that's how we like continue the work, right? If we were all just like, I'm done, I'm checked out, nothing would happen. Like, we have to like prioritize ourselves and show up for other people so that the work can continue, and that it is normal to feel helpless. It is very easy to fall into that train of thought. But once you're in community, you realize that other people keep you going, that the work keeps you going, that even if it's like a community closet, as small as that might sound to someone, that gives me hope to be like, this is how I'm showing up for people, and it connects me to other people, and I'm doing this, and other people are doing this work, and other people are doing this work. And that really does like give you hope, because people are always doing something as small as whatever, feeding people, clothing people, doing mutual aid. Like, people are still giving you that hope. And that's why it is important also to be in community with other people.
Yes. Like, always know that like your little thing impacts, because there's a lot of other people doing little things as well. Right. So being part of community allows you to see the bigger picture and see how you're all contributing to a better future.
All right. Thank you so much, Cassandra and Ruben.
Thank you so much for having us.
Of course, we loved having you in our space and introducing our conference. Yeah, thank you.
All right. Before we leave, I want to give a huge shout out to all of our I Know Her level patrons. That includes Fernando, Medium, Tate, Anna H, Ames, Amy, Layla, Lisbeth, Sarah M, Yulitza, Chrissy, Gianna, Miguel, Yasmin, Jocelyn, Erica, Alejandro, Justine, Magdalena, Ronnie, Bianca, Sari, Daniel, Jen, Abigail, and Aranya. Thank y'all so much for your support. And again, if you also want to be featured in the credits, feel free to support us on Patreon. The link is in the description. All right, see y'all next episode.